Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. In keeping with the Buddha's encouragement to ensure that these teachings are freely offered to all, we do not have any set dues or fees associated with any of our classes or media. In an effort to sustain our ability to do so, we ask that you contribute via our website at againstthestreamnashville.com by clicking the Donate tab, or via the mobile app Venmo by sending a donation to the username at ATS Nashville. Enjoy. Tonight I'm going to continue a series of talks that I've been giving on the five hindrances, which I'll talk about in a second. I started this series on Sunday and I spoke on the topic of aversion, anger, and resentment. And tonight I'm going to talk about craving and clinging. An overview of the five hindrances. The five hindrances are qualities of our mind or mental states or attitudes of our mind that we frequently experience, that human beings experience often and a lot, that often obstruct clarity of mind, and they often also lead to a lot of destructive behaviors. So they both kind of cloud the mind and they create a lot of reactivity. One of the things, well, I'll name the five to start, and then I'll talk a little bit about the five hindrances. The five hindrances are craving, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, and doubt. And so you may notice, oh yeah, those are all pretty familiar to me. Craving, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, and doubt. We commonly experience these mental states. They oftentimes create a lot of confusion. We lose clarity of mind when we're caught up in craving and aversion. We lose clarity of mind when we feel sleepy and dull and tired or restless or full of indecisiveness and doubt. And we also often act these mental states out and create a lot of destructiveness when we're experiencing them. So the practice in Buddhist psychology, the interesting thing about talking about the hindrances is, again, it's important to not look at these as states of mind that we need to get rid of to meditate. They're not getting in the way of meditation. They're actually becoming our meditation object. They're something that we're trying to deepen our interest in and deepen our ability to cooperate with these states of mind. Right? So we're really working with the hindrances, not necessarily trying to like push them aside. So one of the core principles that the Buddha offered, different than other spiritual teachers of his time, is that he was really interested in how we create habits through how we think. He was really interested in, you know, this idea gets its basis in behavioral psychology in our Western world, which is that whatever you practice, you get better at. You practice a sport, you get good at a sport. You practice language, you get good at language. You practice obsession and worry, you get good at obsession and worry, right? Your mental activity is also kind of, it's an activity, it's a behavior. And so one of the famous discourses, the Buddha says, whatever one thinks and ponders upon will become the inclination of their mind. And the idea is that mental states condition behaviors and behaviors condition traits or dispositions. So everything really starts with the mind. And this is another famous discourse. The Buddha says, all phenomena, all experience is preceded by the mind, right? And is ruled by the mind. That our mind is the forerunner of our action. And so we want to have a lot of interest in what our mind is doing. And the practice of mindfulness is for the purpose of what he calls yonaso manasikara, careful attention. To be full of care and how we attend to our thoughts, and to be careful about what we do up here. And these hindrances are areas that we both need to, and this both of these are important, to be careful how much we entertain them, but also full of care in how we meet these mental states and attitudes. In morphic resonance, this is a biology concept. They say that Habits are subject to natural selection. The more often they're repeated, the more probable they become. So the idea here, it's a simple concept, but that they say that once something occurs in nature one time, it's exponentially more likely to occur again. The first time something happens, it's like a mystery of this world, you know, how something's born into nature. But once something happens, it's exponentially more likely to occur again. That habits are subject to natural selection. The more often they're repeated, the more probable they become. So the most common hindrances that we experience, I think, are the first two, craving and aversion, which are really the same thing in a lot of ways, but they're different themes on the same thing. They're both wanting. One's wanting for, one's wanting not for, to get rid of. So they're two sides of the same coin. And it's part of our biological disposition as a human species. It's a part of our neurobiology that we crave and that we want. And there's a neuroscientist named Melvin Connor that studied the human nervous system. He said that all human beings have a subtle internal state of anxiety and desire. He said, best described by the phrase, I want, spoken with or without an object for the verb. Right, so what he's saying is that we have a wanting disposition, that all human beings want. You ever feel like you're wanting something you don't even know what you want? Yeah, the mind will make up something to want. It will go out and it will try to find that thing. And that's the thing we're looking at a lot in mindfulness, is just that tendency of the wanting and then the mind creating an object to want. Say, I'm sitting here meditating. I drove all the way out here to meditate, right? So I'm going to meditate. I'm sitting down. My mind just comes up with all of these things I could rather be doing, or the things that I should have done or could have done this past week, or I want to do later, the Netflix show I want to watch later, you know, what I want to eat for dinner. All of these desires of the mind. And so our evolutionary biology, you know, sets us up for this. So one of the things that's very clear in the Buddhist teaching is he is not saying it's your fault. He is saying that we've got to do something about it. It's our responsibility, right? Because wanting, craving, aversion, these types of things get us into a lot of trouble. Our craving for comfort and security, right? If we just look at our relationships, loneliness, texting the ex, or you know, what do we do? All the crazy things I've done when lonely. Wanting connection, wanting comfort, wanting. So our biology has this kind of drive on one level for nourishment. And the problem with the design of our nervous system is that it's come to equate pleasure with comfort and safety. Right, so when my brain feels comfortable, when my brain feels good, I feel safe. Like, that's how the brain works, the reward system of the brain. It's very simple. It's neuroscientists say we're in a need of an upgrade. Right, we're like operating on the 1.0 system. And they say that actually your executive function, your rational problem-solving brain, a lot of times what it does is it rationalizes the drives of your comfort-seeking brain. Right? So that's kind of a trip, is that a lot of times I'm rationalizing all the ways I want comfort. And so I say all of that to say that it's not our fault, but it's our responsibility. The brain has come to equate high caloric food and sugar with, high rewards, because those things were hard to find when we were hunting and gathering. You know, so you come across a berry, that is a big reward because it's like, oh, finally I get some sugar, right? I get some carbohydrates. That's good, and the brain has learned to reward these things. But now I can go anywhere 24/7 and get tons of sugar and tons of whatever I want. The world has a silver platter of options for nourishment, also for connection and attachment. We're wired from birth to connect and to attach based on survival. Based on survival, we need a caregiver. If you're born into the world and you don't have someone to take care of you, you won't live. And so we seek the connection, the attachment of another. You know, we prioritize then things like attractiveness, sexuality, praise and status in our later lives, things that approximate connection. And so connection's great. We want, we need connection. That does make us feel safe, but we approximate it. You know, by having sex and by trying to find the most attractive partner, be the most attractive partner, and trying to find a way that we can, you know, gain recognition and status. And also other simple strategies, addiction, drug and alcohol addiction. The thing I love about drug and alcohol addiction as a craving strategy is it's kind of the best one. It goes straight to the source. You don't have to fuck with other people. You don't really have to worry about like doing my hair or whatever. I just get to go get dopamine and norepinephrine, right? It's like, woo, that's it. You know, you can even isolate in your room. You don't have to talk to a single person. You can just get that right into the system. So, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, in a way that we're all recovering from addiction. The addiction is the strategy of our lower brains. It's not our fault. It's our responsibility. So one of the inquiries, one of the things we're looking into is just to be honest about how much of our daily experience is driven by seeking comfort and pleasure. And that's just this really simple, and if I just never went past that as a mindfulness practice, that's pretty much going to do about 70% of the job. How much of my daily experience is driven by comfort and pleasure? And is it truly bringing comfort and pleasure, or is it bringing restlessness, irritability, discontent, dissatisfaction? This is not, the Buddha's teaching is not a philosophical undertaking. It's not whether I believe in craving and whether I think, it's an invitation to practice. It's also not a theological commandment. It's not saying you're a craving human being and you need to stop. It's neither a philosophy or a theology in that way. It's a investigation. It's an invitation to look at the motivations of our own thoughts that drive our craving and obsessions. And the first thing I want to look at is this difference between desire and craving. There is a difference between desire, craving. In Buddhist psychology, there's this book of discourses called the Abhidhamma, and it's the books that break down the Buddha's discussion about the mind and how the mind works. It's really fascinating. And one of the parts of the Abhidhamma is it looks at these mental factors, just like mental qualities that we have. And desire is one of the mental factors, and it's a neutral, or they actually call it an ethically variable mental factor. So what that means is that depending upon how you approach desire, it can either be a wholesome mental factor or an unwholesome mental factor. So in and of itself, desire is not good or bad. It's neutral ethically from a Buddhist perspective. It's what we bring towards it. One wholesome form of desire that the Buddha talks a lot about is chanda. And chanda is an eagerness to commit and apply oneself to a goal. Without some desire, we wouldn't be in this room right now doing this. You know, this is a wholesome desire. I want to live a meaningful life. I want to live with more purpose, more mindfulness. Whatever reason brings us out here, we have some type of willingness or eagerness to commit ourselves and apply ourselves to some goal. I want to read this quote by Ajahn Suchito. He says, desire as an eagerness to offer, to commit, and to apply oneself to awakening is called chanda. It's a psychological yes, a choice, not a pathology. In fact, you could summarize Dharma training, which is what we're doing here, as the transformation of craving, or tanha, into chanda, which is wholesome motivation. It's a process whereby we guide our voluntary actions, grab and hold on to the steering wheel, and travel with clarity toward our deeper well-being. So we're not trying to get rid of desire, which would be another kind of desire. Instead, we're trying to transmute it, take it out of the shadow of gratification and need, and use its aspiration and vigor to bring us into light and clarity. So we're really working with desire and transferring or, connecting with that desire into something that's wholesome, something that's skillful, something that builds on our well-being. Now, craving and clinging, really, they come from this root word. Craving comes from this root word, tanha, which actually means thirst, which I think is one of the best definitions or easiest translations from English into Pali Sanskrit and all the Buddha's teachings, because that makes sense to me, thirst. Wanting, having to have. It's the desire to pull something in and feed on it. That feeling, that insatiable thirst. Tanha, unlike this ethically neutral desire, or especially as it opposes chanda in that it's not a choice, it's a reflex. It is a desire that's never satisfied because it just shifts from one emotional need to the next, from one sense of achievement to another goal. It's the desire that comes from a black hole of need, however small and manageable that need is. That's what Ajahn Sucitto says. Right? That craving doesn't matter what object it takes a lot of the time. It's just kind of like moving through the world. The Buddha called this perpetual wandering, is continuing to try to find our satisfaction in people, places, and things. And not that people, places, and things aren't satisfying, but that when I put all of my stake, right, when I put my happiness depending on those things, I'm always unsatisfied. Because things change, and because you can't hold on to those things, and because when they change and they leave, we experience that loss. So the practice is not to not have those things, but it's how do we hold those things with an open hand instead of a closed fist. It's really, that is the difference. That's the symbol of the Buddha's Dharma in a lot of ways. It's how do I walk through life with a receptive openness instead of a gripping, insatiable need. There are three types of craving the Buddha talked about. I want to talk about these and a couple ways to work with them, and then I'm interested to hear what other people have to say. I'm sure we all could share something on this topic. The first type of craving that the Buddha highlights and talks about is what's called kama tanha, which is a craving for sensory input or sense desire. I want to read a little bit about this as well. If you abstain from any specific sensory input for a few hours, you'll probably experience the itch and hankering of this thirst. It's a part of what motivates our day, isn't it? But when you look at it, this form of desire puts us in a pretty dependent and needy position because all those sensory things pass and are subject to a supply that we can't always rely on. And because the fulfillment that sensory input provides doesn't last, it's a supply that gets exceeded by demand. In fact, the more you get used to sensory gratification, the more you depend on it, and the more you want it. It's addictive. This type of sensory craving Is the reaching out to fill our sights, our smells, our tastes, the sounds that we hear, the feelings that we experience, right? Of the five senses, it's that moving out to try to get something to fill and to satiate. Right? It's this kind of very basic human drive that is almost so simple that it's easy to dismiss it. It's really something that we all know very well, but something that is very foreign, or feels like, to me at least, to part of my exploration on a daily basis. A little more so now than it used to be, but I still let my sensory experience kind of lead me a lot of the time. I'm feeling tired, I just grab a coffee. You know, I'm feeling bored, I grab my phone. I'm feeling anything, I grab something. The Buddha said there's lots of happiness to be found in sense desire, and good food and laughter, artwork, nice pairs of shoes. There's a lot of joy to be had in sense pleasure. And he actually talks about it. He calls it, there's a teaching on sukha or contentment. And he says there's lots of sukha, there's lots of contentment in these things. And he says that actually that his teaching doesn't require anyone to let go of any of these things in the world, only their attachment to those things. And then you're like, shit, he kind of tricked you on that one, right? It's like, well, easier said than done. But it's the subtle ways that we develop dependence. We're really looking at our dependence on sense experience. And so how do we work with this? We all have dependence, caffeine, nicotine, drugs and alcohol. We depend upon, you know, sensory experience to get us through our feelings, our feeling states. When we feel overwhelmed, we feel lonely, we feel tired, we feel any kind of way, we often develop a dependence. And so what we're really looking at is that dependence. A couple things that help us to work with this is, you know, awareness and equanimity. Awareness is just once we come to recognize our dependence and see dependence is a very uncomfortable and a very unsatisfying experience. So when I actually look at my dependence on sense experience, we develop in mindfulness this what they call dispassion. We get sick of it. This is what's happened. I've quit nicotine like 5 or 6 times in my life for periods of time. And every time this has been my experience. It's not for everyone, but it's that I get sick of it. I do it and I want to stop, but I can't stop. I pick it up and I do it again. And I want to stop, but I can't stop. I pick it up and I do it. And I get so sick of that dependence that that's the when the pain outweighs the consequences type of experience. And the Buddha says more of that. There's the pain that leads to more pain, and there's the pain that leads to the end of pain. Either way, it's painful. It's the dilemma of the Dharma. They call it the wisdom of dissatisfaction. It's like, oh, fuck, this doesn't really work anymore. This isn't, you know, and that dispassion that comes from that. Equanimity is a huge aspect of this practice as well. It's that if we can learn to tolerate the underlying discomfort that usually causes us to reach out and grab after these things, there's usually some restlessness or there's some loneliness or fear or sadness. There's some type of underlying experience that drives that reaching out and grabbing. And if we can learn to tolerate that first arrow of discomfort, we don't have to feel the second arrow of disappointment, regret, shame, right? Or just the physical feeling of being hungover or whatever it may be, right? If we can learn to develop some equanimity, equanimity is this ability to be with our present experience without having to push or pull on it. It's an ability to be with. It's the letting it be before we let it go. If you want to let something go, you first have to let it in. I'm not going to let go of anything that I think still serves me. Never have. Don't think I ever will. Now we let go of things and we pick them back up. It's a different story. But when we let it in, we see, this isn't serving me, then we let go. And developing that tolerance for that first arrow of experience. The second way to work with kama tanha, or this craving for sense desires, to practice renunciation. This is a big part of the Buddha's teaching, is like living more simply. My favorite definition for renunciation is, it comes from this word nikama, which means not needing anything extra. If I even just do that, that's a scary reflection. If I just look at my life and what don't I need? There's a lot that I don't need. And it's, you know, it's kind of funny, but if we look at a global scale, it's actually going to destroy this planet and our human race. It's actually a huge problem. Possessions. Having to have all of the things, all of the stuff. And so this isn't a guilt trip, but it's a dispassion. It's a, that should make us sick. You know, that hurts to have to, then we have to maintain all the shit that we have. And then we run around in life and we're just maintaining things that are falling apart and getting new things that are falling apart and trying to give those things to other people when we die. It's like, what are we doing? We're juggling. It's like spending a whole lifetime just juggling shit. It's like, why don't you just stop juggling so much shit? You're juggling 5, 6, 7 balls or pins or whatever, chainsaws. You know, how about doing 2 or 3? And this is, you know, this is a good reflection. It's a healthy reflection. It's just looking at what's extra and where can we let go a little bit. The interesting thing about letting go of stuff is they call this the joy of renunciation. It brings fulfillment. There's something really joyful about living a simple life. And it's part of the practice when lay practitioners, meaning non-monks, go on retreat, meditation retreat. You give up communication, your phone, you don't write, you're only given meals that are offered to you, you don't pick your sleeping place. You're just kind of given the conditions for you to live in, and you accept them. And it's been so interesting for me and very rewarding for me going on retreats to go to a place and to look back in hindsight. It's being on a meditation retreat is very difficult. But when I look back on the experience of how much joy I actually felt in not having to juggle or to take care of all of this stuff, that I was just provided meal, I was just provided, you know, what I needed to live. And monks do this, people that take up robes and they practice the Buddha's Dharma. It's why they do this, is they want to commit themselves to awakening. And it's just a little bit easier to awaken when we have less shit that we have to worry about. And not in a dismissive way. The, you know, monks still teach in the world and they still are activists and they still engage with these worldly problems. But they make a decision not to participate in all of these worldly endeavors. I trust that too. There's something about that that I trust. When I'm sitting with a monastic, I have all this like rebellious teenage, I don't know what it is, cynicism towards gurus. I'm a very non-spiritual Buddhist. I actually have a hard time with it. I struggle with it a little bit. It's faith and confidence in the path. Because I approach, for me, not that all Buddhists are like this, I approach this path as an atheist. You know, and so I've had this kind of distrust. And there's something about the monastic tradition. There are a lot of wrong things that are problematic about the monastic tradition. But there's something about sitting with a monk where I know and I can trust in their intention behind teaching. Because I'm not giving them money. They're not going to try to hit on me. Maybe they will. They'll get kicked out. Right? They just teach purely for the service of the Dharma, for the teachings, because they love and they care for these teachings. So there's something also about just our integrity that gets protected through renunciation. You know, if the CEOs didn't have to take the huge paycheck, and, you know, there's something about the integrity of that. Second type of craving, bhava tanha. Bhava tanha means craving for existence or craving to become what you are not. This is a little bit different than craving for sensory experience. It's more abstract. It's more about, I call it the craving of deficiency. As it is right now is not enough. If only I was this way, then I would be happy. Once I get the job or the right house or the thing, I want to become the person that has the thing that is favorable. Out of all craving at this point in my practice, this is the one that is the biggest pain in my ass. You're going on retreat for a month and sitting there watching my mind just want to be someone on retreat. I'm like, I have no one to be. For a whole month, you have no one to be, and the mind just wants to be someone so bad. It's like, oh, that teaching was great. I'm going to write that down. No, I can't write that down. I want to write that down so I can share that with someone so they can enjoy it. You know, I want to get back to my life. I'm going to change all these things in my life so I can become the person that I want to be. You know, I want to be the smarter, stronger, healthier, wealthier version of myself. So again, there's this like desire I would like to be is different than I need to be, or I have to be, or once I get, then I'll be happy. That dependence on the becoming. The problem with craving for existence is that there's a false promise. There's this kind of like, do we ever get there? Do we ever stop becoming the next self? You know, there's always a new version of me that I want to become. You know, this is what I wanted to become 5 years ago. Right here, right? This was more than I wanted to become 5 years ago. And now I want to become something else. It's like, I don't know, man. Running a meditation center, it's a very thankless job. My mind's so unsatisfied with everything. You know? And it's important to have that why. That's why practice over time is so beneficial, is you just get to kind of see your mind do this and you're like, oh my God, I'm not going to buy that one this time. And there's something about, and this is just like my own opinion, there's something about like an existential loneliness that drives craving to become. There's something about not wanting to be ordinary and not wanting to be alone in our ordinariness. You know, our culture is obsessed with individualism. You know, look at me, look at me, look at me. And it's not our fault, again, but it's our responsibility. It's like, we want to be someone. We want to be someone. I think the Buddha would say, just help someone. Stop trying to be someone. Help yourself, help someone else. That's someone to be. That's a good person to be. Becoming also creates lacking. It steamrolls over the possibility for the serenity in the here and now. So when I want to become something, I create my own dissatisfaction. I'm telling myself, I'm giving myself the message that who I am right now is not good enough, or it's not tolerable. So what are these things for you? These are things that we can think about. You know, what are these things for you that you want to become? For me, I became in the last year married. I bought a house. I'm changing my role here. I'm still a director of programming, but I'm moving out of being a director of the operations. There's a lot during especially times of transition, if we're looking at working with becoming, when we're changing roles, looking at the fragility of our identity is like how the identity, especially when roles are changing, is trying so desperately to hold on to something. This has been really hard for me, and it's funny because it's like a total Cadillac problem. If I look objectively at my life this past year, best year of my life. I got married, I got a house. It's pretty cool. I make a little bit more money than I did, and as a social worker, that means a lot. So, yeah, objectively, and my identity is changing a lot. You know, I'm looking at a family. I have own a house now. Before, I could just kind of up and leave and do whatever I wanted. And there's this kind of like gnawing sense of identity internally. It's like, how do I be amidst my friends, and how do I be amidst my communities, and who am I now? And where the practice of anatta, the Buddha's teaching on not self, is that you're not a permanent self. Your self is always in process. Your self is always changing. How we work with this is looking at, like I said, bringing awareness to times of transition. What identities are we holding on to? Checking our intentions. What's the fantasy, the story, or the picture that my mind's painting about this person I want to become? We do this also in relationships. This is an interesting thing they study in, they call it the stages of intimacy, which I think a lot of us will be familiar with. The first stage of intimacy is what they call the honeymoon phase. And the honeymoon phase is an inaccurate picture that you project onto the person that you're attracted to. So that's actually a necessary stage for intimacy, because without that, if we just went into the second stage, which is called the landing stage, which is where you start to learn who the person is, right? You know, then we would have a lot less population. Maybe that'd be a good thing. Who knows? But the, you know, honeymoon phase is kind of story, inaccurate story. I love this, also looking at this as like a single person, a person that's in a relationship. I was single for a lot of my adult life, 6-7 years out of a, you know, 12-year period of time. About almost half of it I was single. And I always had this like wanting to become the relationship. I wanted the partner, I wanted the thing. And then there's also the dissatisfaction of being in the relationship, you know? And the wanting, I mean, we got to be real about our minds. The mind wants something else, or the mind doesn't want something. And that we look at this part of the mind in all areas of our lives. It's pervasive. All right, last but not least is what they call vibhava tanha, which is craving for non-existence, craving to get rid of some part or all of our experience. Subtle forms, body image, this is a big one, not wanting to be this body, wanting to be the bodies that we see, the bodies that the world tells us we should be or should have, wanting to get rid of aging, not wanting to be the aging body, we are an aging body. You know, not wanting something that is real about experience. That is a infuriating argument to have, one that you know you'll lose. But we have them a lot. You know, looking even at body image, my wife does a lot of work with intuitive eating and, you know, body acceptance, and looking at how, you know, people that are in big bodies, have you ever been in a little body? You know, when are we going to stop this fight of conforming ourselves into some really delusional version of what we feel like the right or attractive body type is? Not wanting. Extreme forms can be also suicide. Depression even works in not wanting. There's a lot of agonizing in depression. There's a what I call hopelessness and despair. And again, it's not your fault if you're depressed. It's not your fault that you feel hopeless and despair. You know, it's something that's very real. It's very valid. I myself came to the Dharma because of depression. But looking at that part of the mind that just wants to stop feeling hopeless, wants to stop feeling despair, wants a way out, which drives depression, because then it creates this identity. I've always felt this way. I'm always going to feel this way. I'm the only one that feels this way. Depression has that isolating, non-existent tendency. Don't want this, but I am this. I don't want this, but I am this. So how we practice with all of these forms of craving is to learn to let go of our reactivity and to open to what's underneath. You know, those that, like, if craving is that impulsive, reflexive, automatic, to be able to have that moment to pause. Again, something so simple we often overlook it. Stopping, taking a breath. identifying, what am I feeling? Okay, I'm really scared. All right, can I be with the fear so I don't have to go be with the ex right now? Can I be with the whatever, you know, that feeling? Because these feelings aren't going to stop showing up. I say this a lot, but I work in psychotherapy with people that have anxiety and depression, all sorts of things. And I ask them, when was the last time you weren't anxious? And they have a hard time remembering. I'm like, all right, that's not going to stop. We can't stop that. We're not going to stop anxiety. But you can get more familiar with your anxiety and you can learn how to care for it. And so when it comes up, you can take care of it. You can take care of that part of yourself. And then it doesn't have to be such a battle with anxiety. The anxiety has some space and you can give it some space. You can care for it and it will pass. And then it will come and then it will pass and it will come and it will pass. And over time, you build your window of tolerance. If we can learn to pause and feel with the underlying experience. Practicing mindfulness, samadhi, collecting the awareness, having an ability to ignore the mind sometimes is a good strategy. Not all the time. We need to also look at our thoughts, but we need to be able to stop and just tell the mind, dude, stop tripping right now. Come back. Focus on something else. If we're addicted to our mind, especially when your mind's urgent. I have to have, I gotta 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 have. It's like, we're addicted to that. And being able to be like, no, I'm not going to listen to you right now. That's one of the foundational skills of mindfulness is concentration, is being able to break the addiction to the thinking mind. Tell the mind, not right now. Also, for people that have been coming a while, even if you're new, having some type of faith practice, I don't talk about this a lot, but like I said, this has been a big one for me, is I lose connection with my motivation for why I do this a lot. I have this problem of really having a hard time connecting with the path that I'm on. I always feel like I'm in the wrong path or I'm not doing it right or... So having some type of, you know, taking refuge is a path that, or a practice that some Buddhists like to do. It can be symbolic. Refuge is taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But it doesn't mean that man, the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, that lived 2,600 years ago. It means your own potential for awakening, your own Buddhahood. Taking refuge in that on a daily basis. I have the potential to awaken. I have the potential with mindfulness to become more aware of my lived experience and to meet my lived experience with compassion today. And I take refuge in that. That's a potential. That's a possibility. I can do that. Other people have done that. There are people here that are doing that. That's the Sangha. That's the third jewel. Take refuge in the Sangha. And taking refuge in the Dharma, which are these practices, this path. That's a helpful way to work with craving, changing our craving into chanda, this wholesome motivation. And lastly, working with these heart practices. If there's really anything I think that we as lay practitioners should work on, it's the qualities of kindness, compassion, forgiveness, gratitude, these qualities of the heart, service. You know, I've never felt worse after being of service when I have been in the intention of service. Now, I felt pretty bad when I've had expectations and I've been of service, or I was wanting someone to give me something and they didn't give me the thing and I was trying to be of service. But when it's been true service, you know, that's a really healthy antidote to a self-centered craving. These are some thoughts that I have. We have 10 minutes, plenty of time for discussion.